On Valentine's Day, we celebrate romantic love. But what about all the other kinds of love? Briallen Hopper's insightful and beautifully written essay collection, Hard to Love, honors forms of relationships beyond romance and marriage, the ones that are often treated as invisible or seen as secondary. Friendships, kinship with adult siblings, or care teams that form in times of illness. She also values more difficult-to-define loves, like loving a challenging job or inanimate objects that can't love you back. Drawing from personal experience, Hopper shares stories about her family, the friends who have become her invented family, pop culture touchstones like John Green's The Fault in Our Stars and the TV series Cheers, and her essay about hoarding is a thought-provoking answer to the Marie Kondo craze. Hard to Love is a series of love letters to the underappreciated forms of intimacy and community that are tricky, tangled, and tough, but ultimately sustaining. Briallen Hopper, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here.
This wonderful book of essays, Hard to Love, I wonder, is there a double entendre in the title? Is it like too hard to love, or are you hard to love?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why I liked the title is because it has a kind of open-ended quality to it, where it could just be love is hard to do, or it could be about what it's like to be hard to love or to love other people that are hard to love. So I like the way that it's there's a lot of different modes of love and difficulty that you can kind of read into it. And I think all those things are in the book.
Exactly. And it's a book about relationships, but not just romantic relationships. In fact, not even mostly about romantic relationships. It's about all kinds of relationships. Tell us about why that lens.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just that romantic relationships are a little bit overrepresented in relation to other kinds of connections and loves. So partly it was just coming from a personal place where I've been single for a long time, and I've noticed that people would sort of assume that the fact that I was not in a romantic relationship meant when people say, like, how's your love life, you know, they just want to know about your relationship status in that way. And I felt like people were projecting a lot of things onto me where, like, oh, well, if you're single, you must be alone or lonely or waiting till you find your person, which didn't really seem to fit my actual experience of my life, which felt very, very full of love. But just kind of loves that often seem to be made invisible in these kinds of interactions.
Well, as someone who has a very similar history to you, I really salute you. For many years when I was younger, I thought that I should be miserable because I wasn't.
Yeah.
But I was totally happy being alone.
Yeah, I think, like, especially, like, we're coming up on Valentine's Day, and I remember one time just, like, running into someone who, like, it was the week of Valentine's Day, and they were like, oh, like, how are you doing? This must be a tough time. And I just had no idea what they were talking about. I was just like, oh, yeah.
Right.
So I feel like there's a lot of love in my life that I wanted to celebrate and try to explore and attend to different kinds of relationships and value them, not just because, I mean, I think the flip side of the way that love gets talked about is sometimes people kind of see friendships as a kind of, like, maybe like a refuge, like love, you know, romantic love can be, like, really complicated or really difficult, and, like, friendships are sort of where you go as a refuge from that. But I think that's kind of too simple too. So I think part of what I wanted to do in the book is just really think about friendships as love stories, to pay attention to other kinds of intimate relationships, like relationships with roommates or adult siblings, and think about them as real love, worthy of narrative and exploration, but also kind of complicated and challenging too.
Yes, exactly. And I'm going to just read a short paragraph because I want our listeners to also hear the beautiful writing that is in this wonderful book, Briallen Hopper, A Hard to Love. And I think it also really expresses so well what you just said, and I'd like you to comment on it too after I read it. I build a friendship shell, and it cracks apart, so I build another, or maybe I find another, like a hermit crab. I walk through the world with my eye always out for sturdy leaning walls with a mix of sun and shade. I try to mend the broken trellises or to tie them temporarily together, or at least to cover their cracks with leaves. I try to lean neither too little nor too much. I try to bear others up even as I burden them. I try to let them lean on me as lightly or heavily as they like. I try to shape shimmering forms, warm and solid. I try to keep shame at bay. Sometimes I fail, but I never rest in my quest for rest, because leaning is a work. I just love that. And tell us about that paragraph.
Yeah, so that's from the first essay in the book, which is called Lean On, A Declaration of Dependence. This was recently published on Longreads. And in that essay, I'm really trying to resist the kind of cult of self-reliance, this idea of that people, you know, what's healthy and normal and good is to be self-sufficient. And I kind of explore the way that dependence on others is stigmatized most of the time, particularly when it's outside the context of romantic relationships. So that paragraph is just sort of towards the end of the essay, and the idea of a friendship shell, this kind of structure, a structure of support for friendship, looking for kind of forms for love that will kind of sustain love, or thinking about love also as a kind of trellis that will sustain you. These metaphors are from this wonderful book called Maud Martha by Gwendolyn Brooks, which I really love and recommend unreservedly to everyone. She talks about, her phrase is marriage shell. She's interested in thinking about it in the context of marriage, but I think it works for other forms of love too, where you just sort of think about the structures of support that are necessary to sustain love and keep it going. So she has this image of a shell, and then I use the image of a trellis, but thinking about love and dependence together, thinking about them as inextricable from each other. So I think for me, this whole first essay is just about trying to reclaim the idea, you know, the idea that of being like dependent or codependent is often seen as a problem, and just sort of trying to celebrate the idea of dependence and see life as a search for places to lean, people to lean on, and seeing that as a kind of mutual relationship.
Yes, and you go very deeply into that, and I'm going to quote again. You say, I believe we are all obviously a part of one another, elements of one ecosystem, members of one body, all of us at the mercy of capitalism, weather, genes, and fate. That's quite a list there.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. Yeah, I think that this there's a kind of combination of a personal, temperamental, my own personal story of being in romantic relationships for most of my 20s, and really kind of organizing my love life around those partnerships, and then after a kind of big breakup in my 20s, having to completely reconfigure my sense of how I related to the world. So there's a personal story in there, which is just about me realizing, like, oh, I don't have to, like, put all of my, you know, affection pretty much into this one relationship, that I can just sort of see myself as part of this, like, web or network or ecosystem of friendship and love. But also there's a kind of political side of it as well, which is just that society would be better if we thought about our connection to each other as just, you know, we all owe each other everything. We all depend on each other for everything. It's just a much more accurate way of looking at the world than this idea that we're all individuals who need to be pulling our own weight.
Yeah, I mean, like, capitalism promotes the idea that we're all kind of, you know, atomistic, independent bodies who are competing with each other, whereas in fact it's probably the most interdependent economic system
ever. Absolutely. There's not a lot of kind of independent self-reliance if you're just a person living in an undercapitalism.
So what gives validity to relationships for you? Something you really explore quite deeply in this book.
Many things. Some of the things that I talk about are the intimacy of various kinds of validity that I love and celebrate in the book. One is just sort of the intimacy of shared life, shared everyday life. And I have a long essay on Cheers, the TV show, and talk about how part of what's beautiful about the relationships in that show is just the show went on for 11 years. And in a way, like, not much happened. And it's just you sort of see people gathering over and over time. And you can see the actors aging. And just sort of the sense of moving through time and history together in a way that doesn't necessarily have to be marked by these, like, a particular trajectory. It's just about kind of gathering and sharing life. So I celebrate that as a kind of validity, just the shared high quantity, low quality time. I also talk a lot in the book about the way that friendship and love can be catalyzed by crisis. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the opposite, but I discuss in several of the essays, I write about my close friend Ash and how in the wake of her cancer diagnosis, a bunch of her friends kind of like came together to support her. And I write a lot about the kind of intimacy that happens in these like surreal critical times where you just have to kind of rely on friendship in a very practical way that you haven't before.
And you also talk a lot, well, you have a chapter about a brother you were very mm-hmm. close to. So this book isn't just about relationship, but also how relationships kind of founder and splinter, which did happen with him. It's in the chapter called Dear Octopus. So first of all, just tell us a bit about your family of origin, and then tell us about this brother and what happened in your relationship and why.
Yeah, so I come from a big family. I'm the oldest of six children. There's a 14-year spread between me and my littlest sister, so I have one brother and four sisters. I also have a chapter in the book that's about my sisters, which I sort of wanted to write in dialogue with all of them. I crowdsourced a lot of the essay, included quotes and voices from all of my sisters for that essay. In the essay about my brother, I write about what it's like. We were the closest He's the closest in age to me. We're just a year and a half apart. And I write about how we went from being rivals in our childhood to being kind of really close friends, best friends in our teen years and early 20s. And then so we came from a very conservative religious family, and he sort of held on to those values and I let them go. And at a certain point, he felt like he needed to really draw some lines in the sand about what behavior of mine was and wasn't acceptable and the effects that would have on our relationship. So in particular, a kind of breaking point was when I started dating an atheist, and he felt that was, going to be really dangerous for me spiritually. So I just, after that point, it was very hard for me to kind of reconnect with my brother, because every time we would meet, there would just be conflict whenever the conversation came to religious issues, which it often did. And I think we both experienced that as a profound loss. And I think we both experienced it as something that we sort of saw the other person as responsible for it. we both felt like in a way that we'd sort of been betrayed by or abandoned by the other person.
You know, it's funny. I mean, of course, I've only really heard your point of view, and I don't know your brother at all, so I can't really make a judgment. But you do talk about the way men are socialized in this society to value independence, not interdependence, mm-hmm. not dependence. And I just wonder if you think that that might have weighed in a bit in allowing your brother to maybe go more quickly to these, to create these ideological boundaries, these definitions that separate, and that, that it would have, maybe it's no accident, it wasn't you, that it was him. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, my relationship with my brother is so complicated, and one of the real gifts of writing that essay is that I did share it with him before, you know, before it went into the book, and I wanted to get his feedback on it. And, you know, we haven't had close conversations for a really long time, but in, you know, after I sent it to him, we ended up having a really meaningful 3-hour conversation with tears on both sides. And it's not like it solved everything, but I felt like we were able to, you know, he doesn't agree with every, you know, with my perspective, but he also felt it was important for me to feel free to share it. So I think that it gave me kind of new hope for the way that that change is possible in relationships. But so there's more going on in our relationship than just gender. That said, in that essay, I write about my relationship to my brother in dialogue with this book, Franny and Zoe, which we both read by J.D. Salinger, which is about a brother and sister relationship. And it's very much a book that is about a brother who lays claim to a kind of spiritual superiority or truth, that he has this kind of floundering sister who's making bad romantic decisions. And then the brother is the one who's kind of holding on to this higher spiritual perspective and just kind of browbeating and haranguing her until she capitulates to his perspective, or that's like one way you can read the book. And I definitely feel like there's parts of that resonated in my experience of what was going on with my brother, and the sort of sense that men are the people with, you know, in a lot of relationships, kind of the power that men have to define and evaluate and judge and lay down the law. So I definitely saw that happening in Salinger's writing, and there were parts of it that kind of emotionally resonated with me. You know, obviously, like, the actual relationship is much more complicated and can't be reduced to that.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Briallen Hopper about her collection of essays and confessions. It's called Hard to Love. Now, you came from a family of hoarders, and mm-hmm. I just found this chapter, Hoarding, is very, very powerful. And it's about our relationship to things.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a bit about hoarding in your family.
Yeah. So I see hoarding as a kind of maternal or matriarchal legacy for me. So I'm one of 5 sisters. My mom is one of 4 sisters. Her mom is one of 4 sisters. And there's just on the maternal side of the family, there's just a lot of women who really connect to and collect things. And there's a particular kind of style of home decoration, which is just very, like, more is more, such that, you know, when I go, whether I'm going to, you know, I could go to an aunt's house and she lives thousands of miles away from me, and I can sort of see, like, oh, yes, this is, like, I'm in some kind of ancestral home. So I think that that's part of what I write about. No one in my family is the most extreme version of hoarder that would require an intervention from the health department, but everyone is sort of, all these women on my mom's side of the family are sort of somewhere on the spectrum, where a large part of their life is about kind of going to thrift stores or garage sales or rummage sales and just kind of sifting and searching and looking for precious objects to bring back. And it's something that I was just sort of educated into. I spent a lot of my growing up life in thrift stores, partly because they were affordable places to shop, but also just because this was my mom's way of just kind of going exploring and trying to kind of find a life, you know, find treasure.
You know, we're talking right in the midst of the Marie Kondo craze.
Yes.
There's this, I think it's on Netflix, there's a series.
Yeah.
And you reference her in the book. In fact, you ask, you know, she's the one who says you should only keep objects if they spark joy. Although she's not quite as draconian in the actual series, but that's her operating principle. And you ask, what if you had an attic and a basement and a garage and a storage unit full of objects and they all spark joy?
Yeah, it's the problem. I mean, I think so. I actually really, as someone with hoarding impulses, like I actually do have a little storage cubicle in the basement of my apartment building, and then I have a storage unit back in Washington State where I'm from, which I write about in the essay. And then I'm also storing stuff in a friend's garage and in a friend's basement. So I definitely am someone with, this is like very much my story. I'm someone who gathers objects and then has trouble letting go of them, but I'm not really trying to change that. But I think that I really appreciate Marie Kondo because I feel like a lot of people who write about hoarders and hoarding write about it from a very kind of a pseudoscientific perspective. They want to label it as a mental illness. There's a kind of a sense that like what people need to do is to just demystify and disenchant their relationship to the material world and just sort of like have a much more utilitarian attitude towards things. And I think that that's completely unrealistic and also undesirable. I think that like in some ways having the ability to experience things as magical is something that is incredibly sustaining and meaningful in the world, and it's not something that I would ever want to give up. It's something that I'm glad to have inherited, even though it does, you know, require like at least one storage unit. So I think that something that I appreciate about Marie Kondo is that she's talking in the language of magic and the language of joy, and I think that that's a much better way to think about relationships to the things that surround us than to imagine that we could somehow drain all emotional charge and meaning out of objects.
Yeah,
or that we would want to.
Well, meaning is really the salient word here. You know, I mean, some objects you keep because they're useful, and you think. And I have more times than not actually found a use for something that I thought way back would have a use someday. So I was glad I kept it. But I live in the house that my parents built when I was 18, and my mother was an artist. So it is filled with her art and filled with my son's art and filled with photographs and filled with objects of meaning that I could never imagine getting rid of, or even, as you point out, taking a picture of them is not the same thing as being able to hold them in your hand.
Right. Yeah, I think that there's something so that objects, there's so many kinds of meaning that you can have from them, and some of it is just tactile, and the way that objects can activate memory and. In the book, I also write, in that essay, I write about how objects can activate narrative and writing, and I write about how both Joan Didion and Marilynne Robinson have these moments. Joan Didion, in her great essay about going home, where she writes about kind of visiting her parents' house, Sacramento, and just sort of being overwhelmed and opening a drawer and just kind of sorting through these random objects as a way of trying to kind of make meaning of her situation, you know, connect with her family members or get some kind of perspective on it. And then there's a parallel passage in Housekeeping by Marilynne Robinson, one of my favorite books, where, you know, little girls trying to make sense of the loss of their mother and grandmother, open a drawer and see all these objects that their grandmother has kept. They're pictures that have been taken out of a photograph album that have the little kind of bits of black construction paper stuck to the back. And they're not sure whether they were taken out because they were especially important or because they were not especially important. I love that so much. But through looking at all these objects, this kind of collection, in each case, it allows people to kind of like come to a meaning or like move forward that they didn't have. The kind of work that they're doing to kind of like interpret the objects that they find gives them a kind of illumination.
Could you say a little bit more about the connection? I mean, if you have something more to say about the connection between writing and hoarding, because I found that a very kind of juicy notion, and I want to know more about that.
Yeah. So I spent a lot of time growing up just sort of like with my mom, and then later when I got old enough to do it by myself, just sort of like browsing in thrift stores, and you pick things up and you're not really sure like how this will turn into an outfit or how it will turn into a table setting or whatever, but like you know that it's going to be a piece of something later, and as you say, like it often does become useful. And I feel like essay writing is just, it's so non-linear for me, and there are so many essays in this book that were so slowly growing over a period of many years, where I knew I wanted to write a hoarding essay for years. And so I was just sort of collecting mental objects for it, whether it was an Edward Albee play or whether it was, you know, Dickens or Joan Didion and Marilyn Robinson or stories from my childhood about a traveling salesman who came to the door and wiped the tarnish off, and my mom was mourning the last tarnish off the brass door knocker. So I just basically, it's just kind of like for years, just sort of mentally collecting these stories, knowing that they would eventually turn into a thing, and just sort of, but it's not a linear process, and it's very amorphous for a very long time. So I think hoarding in terms of just sort of like collecting things for reasons that you don't fully understand at the time, hanging on to them, just sort of like returning to them to kind of find some meaning in them that might not be obvious to other people. It really is the best kind of analog I have for my writing process.
That's wonderful. Now, you teach creative nonfiction at Queens College, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, so what is creative nonfiction as opposed to nonfiction in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think nonfiction in general might include books that are written more to kind of give information, you know, whether or not they provide any kind of sense of literary pleasure, mm-hmm. or whether or not the people writing them are just in kind of literary creativity. So one of the things that's great about the term creative nonfiction, like the term essay, is that it's just so capacious, and it can include cultural criticism or memoir or reported pieces, or, you know, there's so much that comes under that, you know, under that name. But I think that the main thing is just the word creative means that you can use techniques from fiction or poetry or experiment with form in a lot of ways, but you're actually trying to create something that's not just about communicating true facts, but mm-hmm. also that has the joy and pleasure that you might find in reading a novel or a poem.
Well, this has just been a wonderful conversation about a wonderful book, Hard to Love, Essays and Confessions, Briallen Hopper. I recommend this book to all my listeners, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's been a delight. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Briallen Hopper teaches creative nonfiction at Queens College, City University of New York. Her work has appeared in the Los Angeles Review of Books, The New Republic, Newsweek, New York Magazine, and many other venues. Hard to Love is out from Bloomsbury Press. Find links to some of her other writing at writersvoice.net.